of inflation. Inflation puts the C in cosmology, where C stands for causal. So if there were a t-shirt for inflation, it should say something like this. And that's why we like this idea, okay? So perhaps more intuitive and less technical way of saying everything that I said yesterday is that the way that inflation does this is it takes one sort of primordial causally connected region and it inflates it to the size of our observable universe. That's it. So why does inflation work so well? Why does it flatten things? Why does it make things homogeneous and isotropic? Because it takes some tiny little microscopic thing and it blows it up to be the size of our observable universe. Simple idea. So let's put some numbers on that. That's something we didn't do yesterday. So I'll draw this diagram again, which we briefly drew yesterday. So on the vertical axis here, I'll have a co-moving scale. And down here we have the scale factor. So you'll recall that the co-moving horizon which is 1 over AH looks like this during inflation. So it's decreasing with A. And then it looks like this in our sort of, we'll call it lambda CDM. So this is the post-inflationary cosmology. So it goes down and then it comes back up. So that if I pick a fixed co-moving scale, we'll call it this, then if I go back early enough in time, it's, quote, within the horizon, meaning it's of a scale, a physical scale that's smaller than this co-moving or physical horizon. And then eventually it goes out of the horizon and it sits out there for a long time until it comes back in at some later epoch like today. So what's the physical picture? Well, here you've got some little tiny mode, right? And then what does inflation do? Well, it stretches things. So literally all I mean is that out here, the physical wavelength is enormous, right? But then the universe grows, so it's not like the physical wavelength of this thing is decreasing, it's just that the physical wavelength, you know, is growing too because the universe is still expanding, but the regions that can be causally connected are growing faster. Yeah? So it's not that this thing starts shrinking again, it's just that the expansion of the universe kind of because they catch up with it. So here we are today, let's say. We'll call that A naught. And some mode that's just entering our horizon now, or some mode that's like just basically the size of our observable universe, or just think our observable universe, came from a causally connected region at this time, here. So let's ask how big did that region have to be in order to birth everything that we see? So here, the physical wavelength, or the physical size of this causally connected region is just the horizon at the time of inflation, okay, the physical horizon. And here, when it comes back in the horizon, the size is just the current day Hubble, right? That's the size of our observable universe, roughly. So by how much did the universe grow? So we know that co-moving length scales remain constant, right? That's just some constant scale. And so that implies that the ratio of scale factors, A naught over A during inflation, is just equal to the ratio of these Hubbles. So let's try and guesstimate how big these Hubbles might have been. So H naught, well, that's something we measure, so we kind of know roughly how big that is. So H naught, you'll remember, is 1 over 3,000 megaparsecs. And if we convert that into a unit that's a little bit more pedestrian, 1 over 3,000 megaparsecs is basically 10 to the minus 26 inverse meters. So the universe is 10 to the 26 meters big. So that's H naught. What about HI? So if I have slow roll inflation, remember the condition for slow roll is that you have potential energy domination. So HI is just going to be that, where V is just the place on the potential that I'm at during inflation. We'll call it VI to be a little bit more clear. So I'm sitting up here during inflation, and that constant potential energy is driving the accelerated expansion of the universe. So in this class, we've gone from Compton scattering, and now we're going to do quantum gravity. So the distance and length scales are drastically different. So the units that we were using before, which were things like megaparsecs and this and that, will now give way to units like M. Planck, okay? And particle physicists will like to express G. Newton in terms of M. Planck and not in terms of like meters and kilograms and things like that, right? So G is 1 over M. Planck squared, okay? And that'll be a convenient unit to use, where M. Planck is about 1.2 times 10 to the 19 gigavolt electron volts. So that's the dimension sitting here, right? So we've got this enormous energy scale. While V, if we look at sort of the upper limit that we're allowed currently by data, this is something like 10 to the 16 GeV to the fourth power. So remember, the potential has to have dimensions of mass to the fourth power, because it sits in the Lagrangian. The action is dimensionless, right? So that's why we have that there. OK, so now we can evaluate this in terms of M. Planck. So 10 to the 16 GeV is about 10 to the minus 3 M. Planck. So this is 10 to the minus 3 M. Planck to the fourth power, or about 10 to the minus 12 M. Planck to the fourth power. Yeah. So now we can very easily estimate what HI has to be in terms of M. Planck. So HI then has to be about, from there, we've got 10 to the minus 12 M. Planck to the fourth. From the G. Newton, we've got the M. Planck squared. And then we're taking the root. So this has to be about 10 to the minus 6 M. Planck, right? So how big was the universe at this time? Well, that was HI inverse, right? And that is 10 to the 6th 1 over m Planck. And 1 over m Planck is the Planck length. Okay, so 1 over a mass scale, we're setting c and h bar to 1, is just a distance scale. So this is something like 10 to the 6th Planck lengths. And that is a very ridiculously small thing. So a Planck length is about 10 to the minus 33 meters, I believe. And that means that 10 to the 6 Planck lengths is about 10 to the minus 27 meters. Okay. So this little patch that we're guessing the entire universe came from was at that time a size of about 10 to the minus 27 meters. It's really tiny, if you think about the number. And so that means that with these numbers, this ratio of scale factors, a naught to a inflation, is going to be something, so that was h naught over h inflation, or h inflation over h naught, excuse me. And so this is a number like about 10 to the 53. Okay. So the universe blew up from the time of inflation till now by a factor of 10 to the 53. That's pretty big, okay. So that's from inflation to now. But of course, we know the universe has grown, you know, for quite a while that we've observed. So the universe was smaller when the CMB was formed. It was even smaller when there was matter radiation equality, et cetera, et cetera. So let's ask, well, how much did the universe grow since the end of inflation? So that, we can guess, is basically the scale factor today over the scale factor at reheating. So I want to know, let's call the end of inflation reheating, which you learned about in a tutorial yesterday. And we want to know how much the universe has grown since then. So during a lot of this time, so there's one thing we do know, which is, well, how much has the universe grown since matter radiation equality? That's about 3,000 times. Okay, that's a measurable. And then during this time, we had a radiation-dominated universe, okay? And the scale factor in a radiation-dominated universe goes like 1 over the temperature. So we can know by how much the universe has grown by asking how much the temperature changed. So that means that this is about 3,000 times the temperature at reheating over the temperature at matter radiation equality. So this is something we know. It's about 3 eV, so we'll call it 1 eV. And this is kind of a free parameter, right? So we, depending on the model we have, you're going to have different values for the reheat temperature. But, you know, maybe let's say that this ranges from a TeV to a few orders of magnitude less than what we had for this upper bound of inflation, so 10 to the 16 GeV. Something like that. So if that's true, then I don't know, let's take the upper bound. We can guesstimate this ratio, A naught over A reheat, to maybe be something about 10 to the 30. Okay. So the universe has grown a lot since reheating. So not all of this 10 to the 53 has to come from inflation, right? Some of that actually came afterwards. So then what this implies is that the scale factor at reheating over the scale factor during inflation, if we just subtract off that 10 to the 30, has to be about 10 to the 23. Okay, so to get our observable universe from inflation, inflation had to blow up the universe by a factor of 10 to the 23. And this, so you'll recall, A during inflation is sort of roughly e to the ht, or that's something we like to call the number of e-folds. And so the number of e-folds of inflation that I need is just log of 10 to the 23. And in this example, it's about 53. So this is the number of e-folds of inflation you need to solve all of the problems, quote, problems with the standard Big Bang cosmology. So this is what you need in order to make the universe causal. So how long did it take to inflate the universe by a factor of 10 to the 23? Well, ht is about 53, so t is roughly 53 times h during inflation inverse. And now instead of a Planck time, or Planck length, we probably want a Planck time. Okay, so that's just multiplying by c. So this is something like 53 times 10 to the 6th Planck times. And a Planck time is about 10 to the minus 44 seconds. So if you multiply this out, you'll find that this is sort of roughly 10 to the minus 37 seconds. And I think this is something to appreciate. So inflation is this really beautiful, fantastic theory that can make cosmology causal. We'll see later that it can also give rise to the seeds of density fluctuations. But it really requires a quite amazing extrapolation of known physics. So we're talking about timescales on the order of 10 to the minus 37 seconds. We're talking about length scales on the order of 10 to the minus 27 meters. And this is nothing close to anything that we see in the laboratory or the universe around us today. Until this year, we didn't even know if there were scalar fields in our universe until we found the Higgs, right? So maybe that's a little bit less speculative now. We at least know one example of a scalar field. But that's just something to keep in mind. You know, this is beautiful. It does a lot of great things, but it really does require a fairly large extrapolation of physics that we know and love. Okay. So that's the big picture of inflation. We talked yesterday about slow roll inflation, what you need to make it happen. We didn't get into a lot of the model building aspects. We'll actually do that after we find the formulas for density fluctuations and come back to it. And then you learned yesterday in tutorial how inflation ends. So the inflaton field decays into radiation and other stuff. So before we now move on to sort of more theoretical discussion of quantum field theory and curved space-time. Are there any questions on this big picture of inflation? Okay, so then we will move on. Okay, so why? Why do we care about quantum field theory and curved space-time and cosmology? Because the claim is that this power spectrum that we relied on to calculate the fluctuations in the CMB comes from quantum fluctuations in the inflaton field and the metric. So our goal is going to be to calculate this guy from first principles, effectively. So we're going to start with some action for a scalar field living in some expanding space. We're going to learn how to quantize it, and then we're going to calculate this. And that's ultimately the other part of the initial conditions for cosmology that we need. This is the part that tells us about the density fluctuations. So the sort of big picture along the way of how we're going to get there. So first of all, we have to have some scalar field that lives in a background, namely the metric is fixed. I wish that someone knew how to do calculations where the metric was not fixed, because that would be quantum gravity. So our ambition level cannot be that high, because we don't know how to do that yet. Basically, the current technology allows us to assume that the metric is fixed and then quantize some fields in that background metric. So that's what we're going to do. And then just like you've seen in quantum field theory, the way to proceed is you go to Fourier space and then you quantize, right? Because if we quantize in Fourier space, then field theory is just an infinite number of simple harmonic oscillators. And I think Sidney Coleman said that physics is basically just increasingly complicated iterations of the simple harmonic oscillator. So you learn, in undergraduate how to quantize the one-dimensional quantum mechanics version of the simple harmonic oscillator, and then you do some more fancy stuff in quantum field theory. And then you do more fancy stuff in quantum field theory and curved space-time, and then you do string theory and all of this, and it's all really just oscillators, right? So all of physics is the simple harmonic oscillator. Done. So we're going to quantize in Fourier space, because then we know what we're doing. And then what we're going to find is that we need a vacuum state. So what are particles? I need to know what particles are if I want to tell you what it means to have no particles. So you need to know what something is if you're going to tell me what the absence of something is. And it turns out that there's an intrinsic ambiguity in an arbitrary metric in making this definition, and we'll see that today. So once we do all that, well, ultimately, if we want P of phi, that's the metric perturbation, right? So that's a scalar metric perturbation. So then we need to quantize our inflaton phi, but also big phi and psi, etc., right? So we need to quantize not only our inflaton field, but also these scalar metric perturbations. But in cosmological perturbation theory, that's okay, because these scalar metric perturbations live in that fixed background metric of a Robertson-Walker universe. So again, this will just be quantum field theory and curved space-time. So once we have that, then this thing that we call P of phi is really just going to be some expectation value of all of these variables, where now by expectation value, I mean, let's put this in some vacuum, say, and figure out what we get. Okay? So just like in Minkowski space, there are quantum fluctuations in the vacuum. They exist. Okay? Now, what inflation does is it takes those quantum fluctuations, which are tiny, and think about the distance scales we're contemplating. Certainly, quantum mechanics is important on scales of order 10 to the minus 27 meters. So it takes these small quantum fluctuations and it blows them up to extremely large scales. And then there's some hand waving that we'll get into a little bit. Somehow these quantum fluctuations become classical and manifest themselves as the stuff that we see in the CMB. So there's this other aspect here, quantum to classical. And so we'll touch on that issue a little bit, maybe in two lectures or so. Okay. So, but once we get there, we know how to calculate P of phi effectively from first principles. So if I tell you your model of inflation, then you can tell me what P of phi is. And that'll be our goal. So let's get started. So first of all, let's start off with a single massive scalar field in a Robertson-Walker universe. So the action for a single massive scalar field in a Robertson-Walker universe we wrote down yesterday. Here it is. Well, actually, this is general. This is just the action for a single massive field in curved spacetime. So I pulled out the half that used to sit in front of here and the one that would sit in front of the 1 half m squared phi squared. So the metric we're assuming is, as before, we'll work in terms of conformal time. So this is just a squared times d eta squared plus dx squared. That's our metric. So this is the metric determinant, square root minus g. And for our metric, that's simple. It's just a to the fourth power. So we can substitute this in to our action. And our action will look something like this. We'll have the negative half d eta dx. And then out front, I'll have an a squared the derivative with respect to eta of phi times grad phi squared, and then I'll have a m squared a squared phi squared. And we can simplify our life by defining an auxiliary field. Okay, so it's just going to make the action simpler and it'll make the equations of motion simpler. So we're going to define a new field, we'll call it chi, and that's going to be a times phi. So upon making this substitution into the action, what we end up with is going to be something where now the scale factor doesn't appear. At least not not out here and not on any of these derivatives. Okay, so from now on, let me get sloppy and say that d eta chi is chi dot and d eta a is a dot. Okay, so dot means conformal time derivative, to be clear. So we can find now the equations of motion for this field, and you can guess what this is done. So here we've got some m squared that's a function of eta, right? So this looks just like the action for a massive scalar that we had here. Say if it was in Minkowski space, it would just be m squared. But now we've got m squared, which is a function of time, right? Because in general, I've got this a squared here, and then I've got the a double dot over a. So we can vary the action with respect to chi to get the equations of motion. If you haven't done this exercise, I recommend that you do it for yourself at least once. Okay, so that's the Euler-Lagrange equations for this field. And you will end up with an equation of motion that is chi double dot minus del squared chi, the Laplacian, plus m squared a squared minus a double dot over a on chi equals 0. Let me raise it up so you can see it. So as advertised, we just get the equation of motion we would have gotten for a massive scalar field, except for now the mass looks like it's time dependent. So you can guess if I have a time-dependent mass, there's probably going to be more complicated solutions than just plane waves. And in particular, what we'll see is that a time-dependent mass can give rise to particle production. So this time dependence of the mass is going to have consequences for the different plane wave solutions. They're not just going to stay constant amplitude or constant frequency. They're going to change. So we'll see a scalar field with a time-dependent mass will lead to particle production. So before we see how it leads to particle production, I have to tell you what particles are. So what do I mean by that? So usually what we do is we go to Fourier space. So let's do what we usually do and go to Fourier space. So we can rewrite chi, which is a function of position and time. And the conventions that we'll use are still with the 2 pi cubed. And then e to the positive I k dot x. So now I have some functions chi k, which are a function of time only. And now I can substitute that back in to my equation of motion. And we'll find that we get chi double dot k plus what we'll call omega squared, a function of eta, times chi k equals 0, where omega is just defined as k squared plus that time-dependent mass we had before. So that's m squared a squared minus a double dot over a. Okay. Why is it a frequency because if I took chi of eta equals e to the I omega eta, then this would just tell me that this is like a frequency. So if I also did the time transform, then this would end up being like a frequency. Okay? So we have a time-dependent frequency. So now let's descend into a few technicalities. So chi is a real scalar. And that means that chi has to equal chi star. And so that puts a condition on these Fourier coefficients, right? Because if I take chi star, I'll get e to the minus I k dot x. So in particular, that means that chi star of k has to equal chi of negative k. If that's true, and I take chi equals chi star here, then I'll find that that statement is true. Okay. So that's just one aside. The second thing is we can now take a look at this equation. So this is a second order differential equation. Ordinary differential equation, and there's going to be two linearly independent solutions of this ordinary differential equation. And so we can write these two linearly independent solutions in a fairly suggestive form. So we'll just expand out our mode functions as follows. So I've got these A minus and A plus, which are a function of k vector. Okay. So A minus and A plus as a function of k vector, you can think of for the moment just as integration constants. And they depend on k vector in general, okay? And these other functions, vk, if I stick this in here, they have to satisfy this equation, right? So those are going to be the solutions that evolve with eta. So these satisfy vk double dot plus omega k squared vk equals 0. And correspondingly, v star k double dot plus omega squared k v star k equals 0. And they only depend on eta and the magnitude of k, right? Why? Because the frequency only depends on the magnitude of k. So there's nothing in the solution that can make it depend on k vector. And since these guys here, vk and v star k, I claim are linearly independent, we can actually check and see that they are indeed linearly independent by calculating something called the Wronskian. So vk and vk star are linearly independent, and that implies that the Wronskian which we usually write as W, V, K, V, K, star, and is defined as V, K, dot, V, K, star, minus V, K, V, K, star, dot. So if they really are linearly independent, then the Wronskian should not be zero. And in particular, it should be equal to 2i times the imaginary part of v dot v star. However, there's one free thing in here, which is that I've got those integration constants, right? So I can take my v's and multiply them by whatever constant I want. So that means that there's some freedom to normalize these guys. And we'll use this to set the imaginary part of v dot times v star equals to 1. That's just a free choice we can make. It'll be convenient. So with these two technical definitions, conditions, what you call them, then what we get is that chi as a function of x and eta is going to be given by 1 over square root 2 d cubed k over 2 pi cubed, ak minus vk star e to the I k dot x, and then I'll have a plus ak plus vk e to the minus I k. Okay, does that look familiar at all? Hopefully it does, because we've just made a few definitions to cast this in a form where this should look a lot like what you've done in quantum field theory in flat space, where once we quantize, these A minus and A plus are going to become the creation annihilation operators, and then these v's you also saw, those were the parts that told you how the field depends on time. So with these nice definitions, we get things in this form, so that now when we quantize, our life is a little bit easier. So how do you quantize a field? We're going to take stuff and promote its operators. Right, so chi, we're going to take that to an operator chi hat. And we could have also defined a momentum, so the conjugate momentum to chi that's pi, which is just chi dot, the way that we have things defined. And so we're also going to take pi to an operator we'll call pi hat. And the usual quantization conditions while I'm erasing, does anyone remember the usual quantization conditions we usually put on phi and pi? Or what? How would we quantize it? What would we do?
Creation annihilation operator.
Okay, so what if I didn't have those yet? What would I do?
Commutation.
Yes, thank you. So we want to look at the commutation relations. And then typically what we would impose, which we will do, is that chi hat at some position and some time, chi hat at another position and the same time, the commutator of these two things is I times the delta function of the distance between the two points. So they commute only at equal points and equal times. And that's pi. Thanks. So chi and pi commute only at equal points in space and time, and then the commutator of chi hat with itself and pi hat with itself equals zero. So these are the conditions that tell us how to quantize the field. Usually there is an h-bar in there, but we're working in units where h-bar is equal to 1. And so now, as you were mentioning, the a plus and minus are creation and annihilation operators. So we're going to take these a plus k goes to an operator a plus k, and a minus k goes to an operator a minus k hat. And so these commutation relations and my definition up there of chi and pi will tell me how to derive commutation relations for the creation and annihilation operators. So this statement is equivalent to the statement that the commutator of a minus k and a plus k is equal to the delta function of k minus k prime, and that the commutator of a plus or minus k with itself is equal to zero. Yes?
I was just wondering, do you actually answer your own question about what are particles in this case?
No, we were starting to go into Fourier space so that eventually we could get to that answer. So we're still in progress of trying to answer that question.
Right, okay.
Yeah, thanks. Okay, so let's start to answer that question now. What do I mean by no particles, right? So there should be some state which we usually call the vacuum, right? And the vacuum is defined by some state so that when I act on it with the operator ak minus, I get zero, right? So this is our definition of vacuum. And so by particles, we mean states where if I act on the vacuum with a plus, here I would get a one particle state with some momentum k. So this is the typical definition of what we call particles, right? So we have these, in Fourier space, we have these creation annihilation operators, and I get a particle when I act on the vacuum with the creation operator. I get a one particle state. And so if I act with some set of these creation operators, I'll get some multi-particle state, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the definition. However, it turns out that there is an intrinsic ambiguity here. So if I look at my condition up there, that the imaginary part of v dot times v star is equal to 1, this has multiple solutions. Meaning I could choose different VKs and VK stars, and all this will still go through. So the only condition that I have on these mode functions are that they solve the equation of motion and that they have this normalization. Okay? But if I pump up, say, V dot and pump down V star so that this is still true, what have I done? Well, I've changed the integration constants. So that means that I've changed my definition of the operators too. I've changed the creation annihilation operators. So this implies that the definition of these operators is not fixed. So how much freedom do we have? We can't just do anything, right? We have to maintain that condition, and we have to assure that these solutions are really true solutions of the equation of motion. So how much freedom exactly do we have? So the thing that tells us how much freedom we have is something called a Boga-Lubov transformation. So if I define a new function, uk, so this is a mode function that's generally a solution of eta, right? And then I have some time-independent constant times vk plus some time-independent constant times v star k. This is just the statement I was making before. I can pump up vk and pump down v star dot and still maintain the normalization. This will always give me another valid solution to the equations of motion, because it's just a linear combination of two solutions to the equation of motion, so that's also a solution. Okay. So this satisfies everything. If we have the condition that alpha k star minus alpha k star, so the magnitude, minus the magnitude of beta squared is equal to 1. So you can show that this condition here guarantees the normalization, and the fact that vk and vk star are both linearly independent solutions to the equations of motion means that any combination of them is also a solution. So this is called a Boga-Lyubov transformation. It's really just saying that I take two solutions to the equation of motion. I can take any linear combination. It's also a solution. So now we can define a new set of creation and annihilation operators. So again, I go back to the statement that these a plus minus are just integration constants. And if I want to maintain all those definitions I have over there, then the new integration constants will have something to do with these different Boga-Lyubov coefficients. So in particular, the right linear combination of those integration constants is that the annihilation operator B that I'm defining for these new mode functions is some linear combination of the creation and annihilation operators that I used to have. Okay. and the creation an operator for B. It's also a linear combination of creation and annihilation operators. So with these definitions, then I could have also expanded chi of x and eta as this integral, where now I would have sitting in here uk b minus k e to the I k dot x plus uk star b plus k e to the minus ik dot x. And that would have been an equally valid Fourier expansion of this field. And in particular, this means, so there are two definitions, or actually an infinite number of definitions of the vacuum. So I could define some state that the annihilation operator for A gets rid of. But I could also define some state, B minus, that gets rid of that state. Okay? And these are two different vacua, right? And you can see these are just linear combinations. So in fact, there's an infinite number of choices that I can make for the vacuum. And they're all equally valid. So which one is correct? I mean, any of them? How do we decide? I wish I had a concrete answer to you, for you, but there is no answer, okay? So we just basically want to come up with some physically sensible thing to say. And ultimately, if you go through this whole story, in the end of the day, we calculate this power spectrum. It's kind of an experimental question if we think that the fluctuations in the CMB come from quantum fluctuations during inflation. That's an experimental question. We can just answer it. More generally, there is no real prescription. So in particular, one oddity is that the B vacuum we've defined up there actually contains particles of A. So how do we see that? We can take the number operator for A and figure out what its expectation value is in the B vacuum. So recall that the number operator is just defined as A plus A minus. And if I use the Bogolyubov transformation that I have above that tells me how to relate A plus and A minus to B plus and B minus, then you'll find that this guy here is just the magnitude of beta k squared times 0b bk hat minus bk hat plus. And now I can use the commutation relation for B and b hat to turn that into a delta function, right? So this is really beta k squared delta 0. So all the delta function means is that, you know, really I should look for a number density. And that's going to be this nk over delta 0. And the number density is just beta k squared. So here we see that this B vacuum actually contains some number density of these A particles. And that's true of any choice I can make. So I could pick an infinite number of these different vacua, and they would all contain A particles. So I guess maybe I'll leave you with that mystery for today. And then tomorrow we'll talk about what physically reasonable prescriptions, or Monday, I guess, we'll talk about what physically reasonable prescriptions for the vacuum there might be. Question?
When you impose the commutation relation, you've implicitly assumed some preferred frame to your space-time splitting. So that means that your commutations are observer-dependent. Can you do it as like a 4D delta function instead?
No. So we're always going to split space-time into space and time. And then basically our definition of particles relies on that, because first we do the spatial Fourier decomposition. And then we define our particles as those states which have a positive frequency, effectively. So it always relies on some specific foliation of space-time into space and time. Or at least that's how we know how to proceed in quantum field theory. So there's always going to be that same ambiguity.
So then definition of the vacuum is always observer-dependent.
Definition of the vacuum is always observer-dependent, that's right. So the reason we usually don't care about that, say, in Minkowski space, is that all inertial observers agree on the vacuum. We'll see briefly that non-inertial observers don't agree on the vacuum, and that's something called the Unruh effect. So if I have an accelerating observer, then actually he would see particles. So if we take your cup of coffee and you start running really fast and you can accelerate really fast, you'd warm up your coffee and, well, you'd burn yourself up, because your vacuum now would contain particles. So you'd actually see that. That's the physical effect. The energy for heating the coffee is coming from your energy that you're putting into accelerating. End of the day. But that's a long